everybody. Welcome back to the Green Mulkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. Today, we are going to be reviewing a story called Giant Size X-Men number 3 in the latter half. This was a celebration series that came out in 2005 to honor like the 40-year anniversary of the original X-Men debut, or the, at the time, 30-year anniversary of Giant Size X-Men number 1. We're currently hitting the 50th anniversary. But this is a short story by Neil Adams teamed with Joss Whedon, which is a crazy combination, like basically the day after the X-Men form. It's fun. It's got some really punchy, blocky Neil Adams art. We'll talk about it in the latter half. In the early part of the show, I'm so happy to be welcoming Marcela Rockwell back to the show and the incredible Michael Sheyache for the first time. Now, Michael and I met already because we've recorded the About to John Proudstar episode before this, but for listeners, this will come out before that one. Let me welcome you both, and I'll have you both introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns, and let everybody know just a little bit about yourself as a professional, and I'd love for you to share a little bit of your origin story when it comes to comics and the X-Men as well, if you will.
Thanks, Chad. I appreciate you having me. So, hello, Na'awe, Studentia. Hello, how are you? My name is Michael Sheyache. I'm originally from Oklahoma, now in the Albuquerque, New Mexico area. I'm a member of the Caddo Nation. For those of you that are unfamiliar with Caddo, you may be familiar with our Caddo words like Texas and many others. My origin story when it comes to comics is quite simple. Reminds me of the Austin Powers opening there. My childhood was quite inconsequential. So,
is it leading to a story about scrotum shaving that I'm afraid that's all right for this show?
Well, that's how I got this, you know. But, So my origin story actually occurs probably when I was a toddler, and then when I first got introduced to comics and superhero, and that sort of followed on my entire life into college, where I started some research work for my book, Native Americans in Comics by McFarland Press. As I continued on that journey, I was able to meet quite a few individuals and even work in the industry as a writer and artist sometimes. I have currently an exhibit for dealing with comics as far as the media and medium at the National Museum of American Indians Native New York physical exhibit that's on for another 8 years or so. So feel free to jump over there and see that. And that's about it, actually.
Fantastic. And such great accomplishments, man. It's great to meet you. Let me welcome my dear friend Marcy Rockwell back to the show as well. Marcy, we must hang out in person. We must.
Yes, definitely. I have to make it over on your side of the country.
I can roll down the hill too. It's all right.
I don't know. The weather might be better where you are. First, let me introduce myself in my traditional language. Buju, Marcela Rockwell, Indigenous Cause, Indonishinabeo, Manawa, Red River, Métis. And that means hello. My name is Marcela Rockwell. I am Ojibwe, which is also Chippewa or Anishinaabe, and Red River Métis. I am a citizen of the Manitoba Métis Federation, which doesn't mean anything here in the United States, but those are my people. I don't remember ever not reading comics. My very first comic that I remember was not X-Men. It was Wonder Woman. Huge Wonder Woman fan, sorry. But it was one of those ones that had the pictures with the record in it. Do you remember those? And I still, to this day, I remember panels from that. And I think I was like maybe 5 or 6. So comics have always been a part of my life. DC more so than Marvel, but I've always been a big Kitty Pryde fan.
Coming out on the show later this month, Marcy, I just had Carrie Harris back on with another friend of mine, and we got to talk all about Stevie Hunter and Kitty Pryde. It was a delightful time. We had a lot of fun.
X-Men hasn't always been my jam. I've always kind of gravitated towards other things, Alpha Flight, mostly because I lived in Montana, which, as I mentioned before, is basically Southern Canada. But I'm always down for talking about comics and getting a chance to read comics that I haven't been exposed to before. So
I'm so happy to have you back, my friend. Thank you for joining us. She's also a talented novelist. We'll talk a little bit more about your work when we plug it toward the end, but I love your work and it's so fun to have you both here. We're going to treat the early part of this as a little bit of from an academic bend, and you guys can share whatever personal information you're welcome or comfortable sharing, but anything we want to talk about is wonderful. In the queer community, we leave behind the kind of heteronormative or straight world and have to find ourselves in a new place. We kind of grow up feeling silenced, feeling overlooked, feeling feeling broken a lot of the time. And there's intersectionality playing into our experiences, but not in a way that we're able to verbalize often, except for I'm different or I'm not normal. And it becomes much later when the labels associated with our identity become much more important. But it has so much to do with the intersectionality of the way we are seen, involving socioeconomic status and gender identity and race and cultural experience. There's so many things. For Native American people in the country, I know growing up Native in this place, intersectionality is part of your very early existence, of course. And for each person, there's a lot of layers to what that means. We tend to just think in terms of one or two when we think about others. But one of the things we love about storytelling is intersectionality and its complexities, right? Storm is an orphan, and Storm is a goddess, and Storm is a thief, and Storm is a leader, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's nice to be able to see these different pieces. So my beginning question for you both today, if you're comfortable sharing, what are some of the intersectional identities that you feel have influenced your own journeys as a person or as a creative professional?
Well, as I mentioned, I grew up in Montana, and I was born in 1970 something. At that time, and still, you know, even kind of to this day, being Native American in Montana wasn't necessarily a safe thing. So I was pretty much raised white. If I could pass as white, I was told to pass as white. So I didn't really, even though I always knew that I was Chippewa and Métis, I didn't really get to start exploring that part of my heritage until I was much older. You may not be aware of this, but Native Americans weren't even allowed to practice their religious ceremonies like powwows and such until 1978. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong on that date, Michael, but it was against the law. So I didn't even get to go to like my first powwow until I was probably 10 years old. And I didn't get the opportunity to go to a lot of them growing up. So even though that's always been part of my identity, it hasn't always been part of who I've shown to the world. And in fact, it really isn't something that I explored until after my mother died, because she was the one, she's where I get my Native blood from. And she was the one who always insisted that I pass as white if I could, because it would keep me safe. Also, being female, that's another, you know, identity that I've had to incorporate into my work. That's that one I can't hide quite as well. I'm also an engineer. When I went to school, I was one of the only female engineering students in my entire graduating class. I'm a mother. I have three biological kids and two stepkids. All of these different things kind of roll together, cook together in the stew of what I am. And all of those different things impact the things that I write and the stories that are important for me to tell. And, you know, also, I'm also a daughter. I'm also a sister. I'm also an auntie, you know, and as an auntie, that's a huge role in Native American communities. It wasn't one, again, that I really stepped into until I got much older, but it's something that I take very seriously. It's a responsibility to mentor younger people, younger writers. It's a responsibility for mutual aid. It's a responsibility to tell the truth and not flinch from harsh realities and to speak truth to power. You know, all of those things are things that I try to do in my work while also trying to tell a good entertaining story.
Yeah. So. Michael, if I can lob this one your direction as well, I'd love to hear you talk about it. But one of the things, and I'll attach this on here, one of the things I love most about your book, because it really helped me frame the experiences as I was having as I was preparing for doing this month of content on the show, this idea of writers latching onto certain types of trends or like a specific type of identity, the noble savage being one of those, or the trusty sidekick, the medicine man, or on the worst sides, the drunk or the abused woman. There's these certain places where we kind of lack a lot of intersectionality and we let characters only represent one thing that can kind of come across in offensive ways.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I can follow Marcy, but I'll give it a shot. That really what came to mind is, you know, first in sort of humorous way, you know, I do a lot of programming and technology stuff. And when I'll go and speak, I'll say, you know, hey, I know we're going to talk about, you know, whatever it is, Python or JavaScript or, you know, APIs today, but you have to keep it simple because I'm just a simple farm boy. And people will normally laugh, but I'm quite serious. You know, I am just at my core, a very simple person from the backwoods of, you know, Oklahoma. And in that respect, when I got to college, something that I really latched onto as we were having classes, and I was lucky enough to go to the University of Oklahoma in Norman. and be surrounded by a really great community of Native students and faculty and staff and everyone. And I bring that up because, you know, we talked about it back then of what I kind of latched onto and called a negotiated identity. So the idea of we as Native people, Indigenous people here in the U.S. have to continually negotiate what we feel like our identity is with, let's say, the U.S. government and a CDIB, a Certificate of Degree of Indian Blood, blood quantum. We have to negotiate with other aunties and make sure that, you know, we have to make sure we know what we're doing. And as I joked yesterday, any grandma tells me what to do and I just do it, right? That's just part of the upbringing.
In my list of questions, I literally have one about your grandmas today.
And that negotiated identity really comes to play for me, right? At least as I think about these. Marcy, when you were talking, I couldn't help but think of some parallels, you know, not with, you know, the female side of things, obviously, but, you know, growing up a certain way. I grew up removed from the Caddo tribe, about 60, 70 miles. It was very hard to get from the farm out to see other Caddo people. I was lucky. I went to a Native kindergarten through 12th grade school, for lack of a better term. They started out as an actual Indian school out east of Norman, and then we just were a higher prevalence of community there. So as I think about it, really, it's the juxtaposition of all those things that have really kind of empowered me and allowed me to do the things I do, right? A lot of what I do is informed by, you know, stuff I learned on the farm, common livestock and, you know, husbandry and that sort of thing. But in the same respect, what I've learned and taken with me along with my academic career and my personal growth is really that same negotiated identity back and forth. Who am I? Who can you allow me to be when whomever you are, like be the government, be another person, be a group? And how does that either conflict or work, right? And when we get into that's a really interesting issue. And we don't often think about, oh, right, you know, I'm this for this community, or I wear this other hat, if you will, for myself. And so that's interesting as we think. I wrote a few years back, I think I called it something weird like, you know, being me, capital M-E, multi-ethnic, right? Because the joke is I'm just as much, you know, parts Viking blood as I am Native blood. Having all those roles and tools and abilities and negotiated statuses can be empowering in some respect.
This is something I think a lot about in my career as well. I'm a therapist and I'm a real person, but in therapy, there's a certain level of professional distance that's there, but I'm also still very much me. And people will relate to me in a certain way if they find out that I'm gay or married or have children or that I'm a writer or that I love comic books. Those little things can influence the relationship, little simple things. People look at my hair color or my skin color or the sound of my voice or my history, how old I am. All of those factor into people's expectations as well. That's something we all carry all the time, but it's not something we always give thought to. Michael, we just got to talk extensively about John Proudstar in the episode that's coming out later this month. When we talk about those kind of tropes for Native Americans or traps that writers get stuck in, which ones do you think John Proudstar is stuck in ways?
You know, that's, by the way, I had to pause because I also thought about the human being John Proudstar is
John Proudstar, the actor and writer. But named for John Proudstar, the comic book character.
My bad. I had to change gears in my head really quickly. So
he's so great, by the way. It's been so fun getting to know him this month.
Absolutely. Yeah. What a treasure. So when I think about that, those tropes, you know, really some of what I see just, you know, surface level, and I mean that specifically, because again, we don't get a lot of opportunities to delve in deeper into John Proudstar, is unfortunately that the trope of what I would call the angry Indian, which really I see more of it. And when we talked about, you know, like the Billy Jack sort of aspect, the angry Native veteran, because there was a lot of people at that time that were both Native and non from the Vietnam War era, in addition to movements like the AIM movement and the civil rights and others of the late 60s, early 70s. So there was a lot going on during the time. But at the same respect, it's not just the fact that he is that. There's also the aspect of, you know, he's sort of like what we would say is, Marcy, I call it the viewership or the gaze, if you will. So for the comic book gaze for females and Native character typically runs towards like the Danny Moonstar, very attractive sort of cheesecake. That's an old term, right? So
and that's G-A-Z-E, everybody, not G-A-Y-S.
And then, of course, the beefcake would be kind of what I see with John Proudstar, right? Like, we don't get a lot except like his physicality and that he has these really kind of super strength superpowers. That's really all about we know. But we get that anger still. And that's a very one-dimensional sort of representation for the character, in my opinion, anyways. I think there's some other like tropes there, but those are the ones that stand out.
I don't think he quite meets the sidekick conversation or the token conversation, because he does have a lot of equal billing at the beginning. But the angry veteran piece, and then there's a little bit of mysticism and then kind of that tracker trope when it comes to his powers, right? He's got the enhanced senses and he can run faster than the buffalo, like that kind of stuff. And then we talked about the costume having religious significance. So there's a little bit, not as much as like a character of shaman or something, but there's a little bit of that kind of medicine man energy for both he and Warpath as well. Marcy, if you'll give people's opinion, is it okay for white people to use the word Indian?
I mean,
this is a little bit of a controversial one, I know, or it can be.
There are Native people who will tell you it's not okay for Native people to use the word Indian. So probably it's best to avoid it unless you, the people you're talking to, really well. I grew up being called an Indian. It doesn't offend me, but I'm not going to speak for all of the Native people in this country, the Indigenous people in this country. Like, some people get really offended by it. I know people who have Native and their background is also that they have descent from people who live in the actual country, India. And so they really, really don't like being called Indian in respect to their Native heritage. So it's a good word to avoid, but also it is a legal term in the United States. In federal law, the reservations, that whole area where there are reservations is called Indian country. That's what it's called in federal law. So like, it's not a term that we can entirely avoid, whether we like it or not.
It's a word that I think to a lot of white people feels very harmless, but we have this entire trope of cowboys and Indians, and that alone carries with it connotations. It's probably best not to use the word unless you feel very comfortable with the person you're sharing that word with.
No, I was just teasingly thinking that Marcy indeed has the right to tell anybody how to say it, because she's now an auntie, right? Like, she has that official ability.
That's right. That's right. I will tell you what you need to hear, and I will do it with biting humor, because
yes, ma'am.
That's how we call you in Indian country.
I think you mean scathingly scalding humor. So yeah.
I'm going to toss two characters toward each of you, and I just want to hear your general opinion on each of these. Michael, I'll have you start here. What's your opinion on the character Apache Chief from the Super Friends?
Apache Chief, you know, honestly, there are some really good memories of the Super Friends at a very young age, right? So
I think you and I are of a similar age. Saturday morning cartoon energy.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can't have the cartoons without the cereal, right? So you got to have the cereal to go with it. Here's the thing, though. Apache Chief, just like we talk about any character, what's that old phrase, you know, we murder to dissect, right? So we can tear down these Native characters and Indigenous characterizations to the core, and we're going to find something good and bad. I think it's very obvious what we're going to find bad about Apache Chief, but quite frankly, as a very, very young viewer and someone kind of like Marcy that loved DC and Superman and that kind of, Superman and Batman, right? Those were my big ones back then. Having Apache Chief present was fantastic. Now, is that character full of problems? Absolutely, right? But I would loved it that there was a piece of me, there was an identification there on the screen. And heretofore, before that, all I had was, say, like Tonto of Lone Ranger and Tonto fame, you know? So yeah, I'll definitely take Apache Chief in Nunchuck or not.
This is a character who would say that phrase and turn into a giant. Another character I'll toss your way, Michael, Turok, the dinosaur hunter.
Absolutely. Also a great character in by the way, for its history and its prominence. So I'll kind of geek out here for a second. As we talk about Turok, right? By the way, going back to Apache Chief, if any of your viewers have seen like the Venture Brothers, there's an Apache Chief joke on that. So be sure to look for that series and the joke. But when we look at the characters, you know, Turok was a character that was one of the longest standing Native characters. He was the first that he had his own sidekick rather than being a sidekick. He was the first that as a Native Indigenous character, he had another Indigenous character, which typically the little step and fetchums or help meets that, you know, the assistants that these people would have, characters in comic books, they would typically be non-Native. They would typically be white males usually. So it was fantastic to see Turok have his own characterization and his own well-written background story. Later on in the 90s, when he got picked up by the video game Acclaim, he was picked up by Tim Truman for Acclaim Comics. And Tim Truman is fantastic. And he wrote, he took that Turok mentality and milieu and went even further with it. He established a tribal identity of Kiowa for Turok. He is one of the few people in the comic industry that really can imbue a wry sense of Native humor into a character. And he did just that. And quite frankly, you know, when we look at the historic from the Gold Key Comics era, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, communities of Turok, we really have a lot of what we would say nowadays is that stereotypical cowboys and Indians sort of look and feel, you know, on every cover. By the way, the good thing is he would usually fight dinosaurs, which is fantastic. I love that. He wasn't just fighting the white man, or he wasn't just a savage. He was out, you know, kind of like Land of the Lost. He was trying to, you know, fight his way back home against dinosaurs. That alone is fantastic, right? So we have all these brilliant sort of ways to take those tropes and not give any credence to them, not have these really tired stereotypes, both for the longevity. Like I said, it was like 40 years of comics. Now, sometimes those were just annuals. They just came out once a year. But then to have a resurgence in the late 90s is fantastic.
It's really fun. You're a huge nerd for Turok. Reading your words about him in your book was actually very educational. And it's really fun hearing you talk about this character. He's a lot of fun. Marcy, what's your opinion on the character Tiger Lily?
Oh, you know, I've seen Peter Pan a million times, and Tiger Lily and Pocahontas. Your listeners cannot see me, but I'm doing air quotes because not her name. All of those Disneyfied native characters.
Which is another trope, the native princess, right?
Yes, exactly. They just, I know some people don't mind Tiger Lily's character, but to me, she's just like a lot of the stereotypical cartoon depictions of Native Americans with the feathers and the face paint and the dark skin and the big nose. She didn't have a big nose, but you know, in a lot of the different cartoons they do. And they're just caricatures. I never liked her. It wasn't a case of, oh, there I am on the screen. It was a case of, oh, there they are making fun of me on the screen.
You know, my husband and I recently saw the traveling Broadway show. Someone gave us tickets. It was truly terrible, of Peter Pan, which is very for children. And we didn't take our kids. And anyway, there's that thing where they're trying to take the old stories and make them new, right? So right. Wendy in this was like the older sister, of course, but she doesn't just want to kiss Peter. She's studying to be a doctor in her future. And then Tiger Lily came on as like, I am the leader of my tribe and everyone listens to me. It was this funny way of like taking if you make the old helpless female characters a little bit smarter or have aspirations, it somehow makes it better. They've done that with Newsies in a bunch of local productions. It's quite funny to me in a lot of ways, actually. And then Marcy, what's your opinion on the character Echo, who is maybe my favorite native character of all time?
I really like Echo. I like that she isn't always likable, right? She does things that, you know, she's not black or white. She's gray. She does morally questionable things sometimes. She's relatable, you know, but she's also has a very strong sense of what she believes in. I think she has a strong sense of who she is. She's a very, I hate to say she's a strong female character because that in itself feels like a trope. She is a strong female character.
But historically, there's been so few. It's something we always love to see, right?
So I was delighted with her show and the Disney Plus show. My kids wouldn't watch it with me. I was so sad they wouldn't watch it with me. Just because she is a deaf character, the pacing was a little bit slower for them.
Again, intersectionality, right?
Right. So it was hard for them to sit still. They both have ADHD and, you know, it has to be moving a little bit faster than the show is going for, otherwise they lose interest. But like, I was really delighted to watch it and as many episodes as I could get them to watch because it was an exploration of some really important parts of Native culture. Like you really see in the show how the opinions of the elders really matter, right? Like our elders are really revered. And that is something that's really different between Native cultures and white culture. Like we multi-generational households are the norm, not the nuclear family is not the norm for Indigenous households. Like if you like having your kids live with you, having your grandparents live with you, your parents live with you when you get older, like that's the normal thing. And we don't throw away our elders, right? So that was something that I really like to see, you know, the not reverence, but at least the respect, you know, that it really showed. And, you know, of course, also there was a powwow. So that was awesome.
I love a powwow.
But before we move on, the one thing I wanted to say about Echo is really, and by the way, diverging from the TV series back into the comics a little bit, I found it was very interesting. We talked a few moments ago about the intersection of several things, and she is multi-ethnic in the comic book. She is, I believe, Latina, Native American, I think maybe Ogallala Sioux. It's interesting to me.
Yeah, her last name is Lopez. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Maya Lopez. So absolutely. And so it's always interesting to me to see when things get translated to the screen. They have this fantastic actor. They decided to go Comanche. These are great choices. It really worked. And as Marcy pointed out, you know, seeing the powwow at a specific location, for anyone that's been to that part of Oklahoma, you kind of, you know, you feel at home. You feel a lot of reminiscence and, you know, nostalgia.
Marcy, would you like to share a grandma's story?
My Native heritage comes through my mother, through her father. So none of my grandmothers were Native. Great-grandmother was, but I never knew her. So I will just tell a mom story. You know, we never had very much money. I grew up very, very poor. We lived in Montana, and my stepdad was a carpenter, a union carpenter. So he worked 6 months out of the year. The other half of the year, he was on unemployment. When you're a union carpenter, you can only take union jobs, even if there are other jobs available. So that also limited the amount of income that we had coming in. We didn't have a lot of money. We were at the grocery store. We were getting groceries with the small amount of money that my mom had because we'd gotten paid. They always made sure we had food first, whatever other bills we might have that didn't get paid, they didn't get paid. You know, we ate first. That was what happened. And there was a lady in the line in front of us who had some small kids who were crying, and she didn't have enough money for the diapers and formula that she was trying to buy. And my mother, without hesitation, even though we had so little, forked out some of that very precious paycheck money, because we didn't get paychecks every week, you know, helped pay for that lady's stuff. And the lady was so grateful. My mom was like, just, you don't have to thank me. Just if you ever have the opportunity, pay it forward. But it was the whole idea that when you have, you give. It's the whole idea of mutual aid. That's what community is. We take care of each other. And this lady wasn't like Native American. She wasn't part of our tribe community in that sense, but she was another mother who was struggling. And my mom did not hesitate, even though, you know, like I said, that meant less for us, and we didn't have that much to begin with. That lesson has stayed with me throughout my entire life, and that is something that I have seen played out over and over and over again in other, you know, with other Native families and other Native people, and hearing their stories like that is, we are not a monolith, but I believe that that is a value that we all hold, our community. We take care of each other. So
one more question I have for each of you, and then we'll talk about silly comic books for a little while. One of the great joys of making this show has been kind of mixing my academic life and my childhood love of the X-Men. I'm constantly learning new things, learning about the history of the Rising Sun Flag to understand the character Sunfire differently, learning about the industrial age and how that influenced the creation of characters like Iron Man or Captain Britain, learning about the Cold War. You know, it's been an amazing thing to learn. Native Americans, just like any culture around the world that has different customs than this kind of very capitalist Christian culture that we're accustomed to here in America, names mean something very specifically. And it's different from tribe to tribe, it's different from family to family, but there's special significance attached to names in various cultures. We tend to see white writers making fun of Native names quite often, but there's a difference between family name and tribal name sometimes. There's a lot that can go into this for different characters. And again, you guys can pass on this, but would you be willing to share a little bit about the significance of names in your own upbringing?
You know, I think that's a very interesting line of thought. You know, I also, in echoing what you mentioned, I think the easiest way for many non-Native people to get even the tiniest understanding and toothhold on different names within a community cycle is a nickname, right? And the reason I bring that up is your grandpa or grandma might have given you a nickname, your best friend might have given you a nickname, and that idea of a nickname is maybe something that you put some personal value or investiture in, but you still maybe legally named something else, or in the Judeo-Christian sense, your Christian maybe name may be something else, right? From my perspective, quite frankly, this is timely for me. I have a just turned 18-year-old son, and I was very grateful to be able to give him his Caddo name, right? I say very grateful because, again, growing up on the farm, you know, removed from my tribe, I didn't receive any sort of naming anything, naming ceremony, a different name. And so it's fantastic that you bring that up. I do think that it's something that it's a little difficult to talk about pan-Indian wise, right? Because even when I talk about what it means to be Caddo and what those names might mean, you know, there was a lot of discussion between me and other Caddo members just to make sure that I had a grounded understanding of what I was allowed to name my son. So I think that that's important, even as a person within that specific group, I still have to watch my P's and Q's to make sure that I'm not making some auntie mad, you know? So, and I say that jokingly, but I mean that, right? Like, that's that negotiated identity that I mentioned, right? We have to make sure that when we go back to our roots, our community, our aunties, our grandmas, whatever it is, we have to make sure we're still doing it right. And I think that's the great thing about this podcast and many others, is that we're examining these things and we can go back and go, yeah, that wasn't great, or that wasn't, but how do we do it better? What are we going to do to make ourselves better? How are we going to be a community? And I think that's fantastic. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you for sharing your knowledge and for writing your book. And Marcy, did you want to talk about names?
I am Chippewa, Métis. They're pretty much the same thing, but the Métis don't necessarily like have quote unquote Indian names. A lot of our names, like my family name is LaFountain. The LaFountains were a very important Métis family. They fought with Louis Riel, who was the father of Manitoba. Family names are very important, but there was still, even with that, there was still the sense that your elders had some input in what your name was. And I know that that isn't necessarily just a native thing, but for instance, my mother was a huge Tolkien fan and she wanted to name me Brandywine. My grandfather absolutely refused. He said that everybody would call me Booze. And he's like, you are not calling my Indian granddaughter Booze. No way. So like he just put his foot down. So like he didn't give me a name, but he vetoed the name that my mom was trying to give me. So in that respect, you know, he still had a hand in naming me.
You know, I think it's interesting for white families. Names are still important, right? Like I take my father's last name. It's culturally traditional for the woman to take the husband's name. We'll pass on a family name. My middle name is a compilation of my mother's parents' names, which, you know, we carry legacy with us. But I think in white families in today's day and age, at least in my cultural experience, you kind of move on from your family in a lot of ways. I can share a story about my parents or grandparents, but it's not from a place of deep legacy. My family name definitely goes back. Now, I come from the Mormon culture, which is like very, very pro, like, you know, a genealogy. And for Mormons, if you're like a worthy member in the temple, they'll even give you like a new name that's like a secret you keep between you and God. Like names are very culturally significant. I had a dear friend who taught English in China for kindergartners for several months. And she received a Chinese name from the family she was staying with. And then it was her job to give an American name to each of the kids entering the school system. And a lot of them kept those names. Like when they would talk to anyone in America, they would use those names for years later. And it's just, you know, this one girl from the Rocky Mountains who gave them a name that one time when they were five. Names mean a lot of things, but it's very different in a cultural tradition where it's something that needs to be honored and respected, both because of family legacy and because of tradition and frankly, sometimes sacredness. Names have a lot of significance and it's not up to anyone to have to explain what their name means or where it comes from. It's not a thing that you get to ask necessarily unless someone chooses to share it. When we see it in older films, certain tribes had ways of naming people based on the personality, the temperament, the way they impacted with spirituality or nature around them. And that's where we see a lot of traditional names that are used, but that's not a thing. The other day we had John Proudstar, Wayote Old Bear, and Jim Terry all on the show. And Jim's like, you know, growing up, nobody knew from my name that I was affiliated with any sort of tribe. So it's an interesting thing to consider as we talk about John Proudstar in the X-Men world.
Just to follow on, I think the pink elephant in the room is my last name. You know, my last name is Shiashi, which is a Caddo word, right? So I don't want to overlook the fact that I was able to celebrate and really flex inside having a native sounding last name over the years. And another anecdote, by the way, which the name Shiashi is very, for the viewers that are not aware, it's nine letters and there's a Y in the middle. But it's very interesting that every time I go to a hotel or check into the airport or whatever it is, if there's a Pacific Islander or Asian presenting individual, they say Mr. Shiashi right off. And I was like, how do you do that? Because everybody else is Michael, and then their name just, the brain stops and they can't do anything. So like you said, I think names are important. And also I find that Chinese name to be fantastic that you're mentioning as well, because it's functional, right? Because those kids can now use that Americanized name if they so choose whenever they want. And that's fantastic.
I didn't balk at Shiashi. cliche, but I live in Utah where there's a strong Polynesian culture. And when I meet someone from Tonga, I have to slow myself way down and learn very carefully how a name is pronounced, because it's worth respecting someone in that way, right? Okay, we're going to be talking about Giant Size X-Men number 3. This is a short story called Teamwork. Again, it was made in 2005. So Joss Whedon is the writer on this book. Joss is, of course, a legendary creator who has done so many things that you have heard of and loved. Joss also has a long run on X-Men in the early 2000s, which is very, very popular. Joss also has been Me Too'd really, really hardcore in recent years and is known to not be a pleasant or easy person to work with, particularly if you are a woman. So we're not going to overly celebrate his work here, but just kind of owning and acknowledging the contributions he has made to some of our superhero fiction. The artist here is Neil Adams, who of course has the legendary run from the Silver Age that we covered. Neil, at this point, Neil died in 2022 at the age of 80, in his early 80s. So he's in his early 60s here, if I'm doing my math right. He did the series First X-Men 7 years after this. And that's a story we've also reviewed. Neil's pencils kind of take on kind of a harsher edge in his older years. The way he draws Wolverine in this book is almost startling. You kind of want to laugh. It makes you a little uncomfortable. Then you're like, oh, wait, that's Neil Adams. And it's still good. It's spot on character, but there's something very edgy and dark and shadowy about this version of him. He's doing his own inks here as well, with Richard Isonov on colors, Chris Eliopoulos on letters, and my friend Mike Martz is one of the editors, as well as Jeff Youngquist, who was my old boss at Marvel Comics when I used to work for the handbooks. Do you guys have opinions on Neil Adams' pencils? Comparison from Silver Age to now, are you a fan, Michael?
I absolutely am a fan, and I really, you know, what kept coming to mind when looking at the comic that you mentioned, number 3, is the visceral, just the aspect of, yes, a raw edge, if you will, to me. And quite frankly, I believe, unless I'm mistaken, I believe I really enjoyed Neil Adams working on Batman many years, you know, into the 70s and 80s. So I think he also did Green Arrow and Green Lantern, that sort of thing. So I'm used to that sort of heroic, you know, portrayal he does in his characters. But I've always seen that sort of that edginess, if you will. And I really think that that is punched forward in this comic. And I love it. I unfortunately have gone to so many cons and have been, you know, an eyelash distance away from Mr. Adams and just never got to go say hi or, you know, tell him how much he meant to me. But I'm sad he's gone, but this is fantastic art.
I have a Neil Adams Wonder Woman up in my bedroom, and I actually have a Neil Adams Billy Jack. Did you know that he did Billy Jack?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was trying to find, I put it away when I got more Wonder Woman art on my office wall, and I was trying to find it to show you guys, but I'm not sure where it is. If I do find it, I will scan it, send it to you guys.
I would love to see it.
It's great. Yeah, no, it's great. I had the pleasure of meeting him for about 2.5 minutes at Tucson Comic Con a few years ago, where he was signing the Wonder Woman print and the Billy Jack print. And my husband, Jeff, knew him, of course, because he's been in comics forever. So they chatted for a little bit, and that was, you know, it was really cool. The depiction of Wolverine in this short story is very startling. Like, it's at first you're kind of like, it's one of those situations where you're like, is this art so bad it's good, or so good it's bad, or, you know, it kind of walks that line.
We've reviewed the series First X-Men on my show. We have a similar conversation. It's after this, and the pencils are just so sharp, and it just doesn't feel like the classic superhero. It's jarring to the eye if you know Neil Adams' work, but you can still for sure see it's him.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like a departure, but I think it also fits this depiction of Wolverine pretty well, because this is, I mean, Logan's always kind of harsh, but this particular story, he's like very harsh. So I think that the drawing helps to emphasize the characterization in this particular story.
We've been doing script readings on my show of these old original issues. If you haven't heard any yet, they're really delightful. I found myself, as I was prepping for this episode, I can only hear the characters in the voice voices of the actors who have been portraying them on my show now. So for everyone who is part of that process, it's really delightful to be doing this. This is kind of a, so we did Giant Size Number One at the beginning of the year, and then we've been doing all these kind of little interim backup stories that fit right after that. This seems to be a story that takes place right after Giant Size. So the new team has just been formed. Maybe the original team has just quit, but it's somewhere in that interim where they are early on. We get a cover that is kind of a Dave Cockrum, kind of John Cassaday workup. That's an homage to the original cover of Giant Size X-Men number one, except in this case, we have Wolverine, Beast. Well, we have the members of the Astonishing X-Men that Joss Whedon was writing back then. So Wolverine, Colossus, Kitty Pryde, Cyclops, Beast, and Emma Frost are in the background acting surprised. That's the John Cassaday piece because he was the artist on that book. With Storm, Banshee, Sunfire, Nightcrawler. Nightcrawler has the biggest shit-eating grin on in this picture. It's great. And we've got Thunderbird, Colossus, Wolverine front and center, Cyclops off to the side. And it's a Cockrum art. And it's that, you know, they're running through the paper Looney Tunes, like torn out in the wall. I'm going to cover pieces of this really quickly, and we'll pause to talk about some key characteristics. As we open the book, Wolverine has called the team into the danger room. We're going to learn, he claims that Professor X told him to do it. We're going to learn he did this on his own. But they're all in there, and he has this big muscular arm yanking the lock closed, lock engaged with a chung. He's got a toothpick in his mouth. He's wearing a pink shirt that is halfway unbuttoned, showing off his like rippling pectorals and his chest hair. But the fact that it's pink and he chose to unbutton it already is delightful with this guy. He has gathered Thunderbird, Sunfire, Nightcrawler, Colossus, and Storm into the danger room. Now, Colossus has come in the tightest white t-shirt you've ever seen. Storm is in a yellow shirt and khakis, and Thunderbird is in a kind of muscly shirt with like a vest, a headband, and jeans. But Nightcrawler and Sunfire have come in full costume. So that's important for just a moment from now. Wolverine, the book's called Teamwork. Wolverine turns to everyone and says, okay, it's your first day as the new X-Men people, so I'm going to show you how this works. And Colossus is so excited. Xavier has just barely downloaded English into all of their brains. And he says, incredible. I'm not going to do a Russian accent. An hour ago, I spoke not a word of English. Now I understand every word. Storm says, the professor is a powerful man. Now, Justin Park reads Sunfire as a very sassy gay on my show, which is really fun for this character. So he says, I would gladly unlearn English if I knew what banal prattle I'd have to endure, or I'd endure. I only joined this team to be among the powerful and the righteous, to do great deeds that the world would. And suddenly he goes, wait, I'm in costume. Nightcrawler's in costume. Everyone else is not in costume. But he notes, the little German's wearing his. Like, did I screw up somehow? And it's very, so this has upset him. Sunfire is now triggered because he came in costume, and Wolverine is ready to fight. He says, we are not a team yet. And then we get this side view of Wolverine looking insane. I don't know, who does this look like to you? This is a horror movie mask, this version. He pulls the toothpick out of his mouth, holds it up, and he looks like Jack Nicholson lost 100 pounds and has like the worst hair day. It's a very odd photo of him. I hate it so much.
It really suggests to me that old Universal Studios Wolfman kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it feels like a mask that you would fully pull on over your face.
I get that vibe, and I also get the Apocalypse Now sergeant kind of.
Yeah, sergeant. You can't handle the truth. I think that's why I went to Jack Nicholson. Oh, yeah. Wolverine says, a real team's got something that binds them. The Fantastic Four, they all got powered up together. Avengers, they're the A-list. Big Show, every one of them. They got a god. I mean, he's Norse, but he's still a god, which is somehow some sort of slight. I don't know. He pops his claws and basically says, he calls Kurt Creepy Crawler. He says, basically, Professor X has said one of us is not going to make it out of here alive. We got to fight, and whoever makes it out is going to be part of the team. So he pops his claws and he basically says, you got to fight me. Let's go. And the team is kind of panicking. These are all strangers. And this man is crazy. He's also a mass murderer with like metal adamantium claws popping out of his wrist. We've been talking about the insanity of him even being on the team. Colossus amps up, which always rips his shirt. This man cannot keep a shirt to save his life. And he jumps ready and he says, this is obscene. We cannot fight like rabid beasts. There's a woman here. And Storm says, a woman who does not need your protection, Metal Man, which is very, very true. And then Colossus turns on Nightcrawler, who he calls Little Eddie Munster. I don't know why we need the name calling so much. We then get John Proudstar turning, and this is a fair read. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this phrase, Marcy. John Proudstar says, the white man man never changes. Promise a glorious future, and then ... Xavier promised him a certain kind of life, but now he's made to believe they have to fight to the death somehow. Is this a fair statement from John here?
I mean, always. Nothing to argue with there. No notes.
So Sunfire turns and says, well, if the professor wants one of us dead, I cast my vote, and fires a full atomic fireball at Wolverine in the room, which is very, very aggressive for this man that he just met. Colossus jumps in front of it, which of course incinerates his clothes as Wolverine goes running. Storm then launches into the air. First, she uses lightning and clouds around her, blows a wind at Sunfire to knock him down, and then is like, oh my god, I've never channeled in a tiny metal room like this, and her claustrophobia kicks in. Crazy, crazy, moving very quickly. Then we get John kind of holding his own and kicking Wolverine's ass for a minute. Michael, do you want to talk about Thunderbird and Wolverine's little sparring match here?
It's short, but it's fantastic. So quite frankly, John, Thunderbird actually gives him a cheap shot, so which is probably some of the only ways you can get a shot in on Wolverine, but attacks him from behind, and then pile drives him into the ground, into his spine with his elbow. So quite a fantastic, and by the way, this is why I love Neil Adams, just the action and the visceral, and you really feel the motion of the kicks and the punches. So we'll talk about that punch later, I bet. So
Thunderbird gives a lot of like pro wrestler energy almost. There's like the elbow slam. If yep. It's death you want, then have a taste of it. And Nightcrawler's fully freaking out. He's no longer smiling. He looks so scared. It's kind of an eerie Nightcrawler face, actually. It's giving me like a little sex doll. Like those like permanent open mouths. It's very uncomfortable, some of this art. He goes, this is the professor's mutant haven. We kill the weak to earn our place. I didn't escape a mob to be killed here. Jumps into the air and wraps himself around Storm for reasons. Then we get the next punch. Michael, do you want to continue this fight for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So using that as a diversion, one assumes, he doubles Wolverine over with a fantastic punch, it says, and then gives him a kick. Well, he receives a kick from Wolverine right after that, which sends him right into Colossus.
So Thunderbird literally says, why don't you show your claws, animals? Wolverine realizes Storm has electrified the room and Colossus is metal. Lightning, metal, you do the math. So you get the implication that Thunderbird's tossed into Colossus and gets some sort of electric zap. The one person who was not here, and Wolverine said he didn't know what they were doing, is Banshee. Banshee suddenly flies in and was like, screams bloody murder to make everyone cower and cover their ears. Are you all mad? The professor heard the lot of you from across town. If he could see you. And they're like, wait, Xavier didn't order this? Okay, this is the grossest fucking thing I've ever seen in an X-Men book. Wolverine was wearing a shirt. He fully takes the shirt off and wrings the sweat out of it, I think, and then puts it back on. It's gross. If it's Storm's rain, it doesn't gross me out as much. But the man is wringing his wet shirt out, and I don't know, ew. He says, of course the professor didn't know. The prof's a decent guy. That's what I waited till we was alone to spring this. And he says, basically, we ain't a team. Then Colossus turns, and his shirt is fully gone. It's just like a little ring of material with some like strands around his neck. He says, you turn against us? Wolverine says, team knows each other. Powers, weak spots, tempers, not from files or meetings. When we're in the thick of it, we'll all know a lot more about who's got our backs. Personally, my money's on T-Bird to outlast the rest of you. I ain't been hit that solid since I scrapped with the green guy, who is a reference to the Hulk, obviously. So anybody want a beer? And then we end with the boisterous, belligerent beginning. Marcy, did Wolverine do good by the team in this issue?
What an asshole, man. I don't know how this is supposed to be a team building exercise. Like if I was any one of those people in that room, I'd be like, yeah, I'm out. You know, that's, I get that you want to know how people are going to react under stress, but making them think that they have to kill each other.
It is war in a certain way, which is crazy. When you stack up the continuity, Wolverine has been used as an assassin and being brainwashed for a long time. And the story that stacks up just before this is in a book called X-Men Origins Wolverine, where Wolverine literally had to murder like dozens of soldiers who tried to kidnap Professor X right before they came to the mansion. So you kind of get it. He's the combat guy in some ways, but it's deeply uncomfortable and manipulative, and there's a lot of name calling. But the most asshole thing Wolverine might do here, you notice the character that's missing is Cyclops. The first chance he gets, he's like, hey, I'm the leader. Like, then I'm going to make my move on Jean Grey later. Like it's very him asserting his dominance over this new team in a way. Michael, what did you think think about the characters here, particularly Sunfire's reaction to just fucking toss a whole fireball?
Well, no offense to Sunfire, but that's quite on brand, at least what I think of it. And I don't think of Sunfire very often, and that's unfortunate, right? Because I think, again, kind of like Thunderbird, there's a fantastic character there that I just won't get to know as well as I wanted to because of, you know, reasons, because of lack
of... You were with me on the academic panel yesterday. We have one out there on Sunfire that's really amazing, actually. Right. If you want a whole education, go give it a listen.
Absolutely. But in addition to that, quite frankly, I can't get the idea of Wolverine, as Marcy's saying, doing the team building process, which makes me think he's part of the HR, you know, like Wolverine is the HR department for the school. Now, you know, a lot of what I see, and by the way, going back to what you're saying, that this is sort of what we remember from all of the X-Men team. Very reactive, very ignitive, you know, easily sparked into conflict. And in some ways, you're right. You know, the backstory of Wolverine very much, you know, matches this. He is the most seasoned veteran, to literally talk about the militaristic part of it. But and in addition to what you're saying, right, like he doesn't have anything to lose. He's been sort of the psycho killer, that kind of thing. You know, he wants to make sure that what he's doing and the people he's working with can survive at least almost as long as he can. So
they are going to be soldiers in a war. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Right. So and I think that in this particular instance, it just reminds me of that same X-Men trope, not trope, but milieu of like they're all going to gripe at each other while they're trying to save the world. And in this case, they just happen to be in the danger room.
So there's a complexity to Wolverine. I've never been a Wolverine fan until this year. I've been researching the shit out of this character. Two things that are interesting to consider. Soldiers in war in Vietnam, Afghanistan, places where you're stationed, there's a very like hyper-masculine culture that tends to form, and it's very one-upsmanship and who can win the arm wrestling competition. And Wolverine and Thunderbird as the veterans here, along with Xavier and Banshee too, there's like a certain level of understanding where the new soldiers are being hazed in a way, which is interesting. The second piece is his nature makes him want to fight. He wants to be the alpha or prove he's on top. So there's a certain amount of charm to the way he's written here as well. He's also drawn so hot by Neil Adams, which is crazy. That whole scene, like his pink shirt unbuttoned to his navel, is amazing.
I don't think that Wolverine is the only asshole-ish character in this. You know, it's like he says, oh, well, one of you has to die. And like everybody's like, well, okay, let's have at it. Like Nightcrawler is the only one who's like, whoa, hold on, let's pump the brakes here. And then even he, for some unknown reason, like my first reaction when he bamfed out of there was that, and he showed up with his, you know, trying to choke Storm out or whatever it was he was doing, was that for some reason his teleportation just wasn't working, right? That he wasn't allowed to leave the danger room.
But right, then, but also Storm was zapping lightning everywhere and somebody had to stop that.
That's true too, but like,
you know, I doubt this was intentional in the story at all, but something that just occurred to me is this may be Wolverine trying to flush Sunfire out a little bit. Sunfire quits the team immediately after this, and he's the only one that behaves in a really unreasonable manner. This may be Wolverine kind of saying, look at the way that guy responded to a crisis, maybe we don't want him rescuing civilians right now. That's kind of an interesting read on this as well, is him making the team stronger as a result.
That's not the way I want my team made strong. That's all I can say.
You know, I will say this, you know, going back to just thinking about Wolverine and thinking about those early years of classic X-Men, you know, and reading those, I do recall that animalistic side that they were really pushing with, quote, the Wolverine, right? With Logan and everything, heightened senses, more comfortable in the woods, that kind of thing. And in this respect, I think that follows that same mentality that I would see in the early 80s, mid 80s. And that's that, you know, it's like the survival of the fittest for him. It's very Darwinian. It's very animalistic. And in that same respect, I have to say, you know, thinking about Wolverine, not only in his interaction and his respect for the excellent wrestling moves that T-Bird gave him, it's also kind of a weirdness. You know, we know Logan and Wolverine. We know his marriage and his affinity for Japanese culture. We also know from some of the cartoons of his having significant others that are Native American, and also the movie.
Silver Fox is a really storied character in the comics.
Oh, it is a real story. Yeah, yeah. And so that's interesting, right? So that kind of plays in my mind. So, like, you know, I wonder, you know, that's great that Wolverine is the one character of the X-Men that can probably fit in and understand inherently, say, Japanese culture or the Native American culture of Silver Fox. But in some ways, that idea of him being animalistic is a little troublesome for me, because that goes back to that, you know, one with nature, child of nature, simplistic sort of Native American and their culture, that kind of thing. And I put "their" in quotations mark. So I think that's some of what gets echoed here for me, is that problematic, you know, storytelling of going, yes, Wolverine is a great character, but he's mostly animal. And in that respect, because he's mostly animal, he has that ability to have affinity for Native Americans and other cultures. That is the only thing that kind of bothers me a little bit.
I fully understand the assimilation. Wherever he goes, he's the white man that gets the girlfriend from the Native culture. He rescues Mariko Yashida from an abusive man, and then she becomes, right? Like, it's a story that we see over and over again. And Silver Fox is horribly raped and murdered by Sabretooth, until they later reveal she was a Hydra agent working with Weapon X, question mark. It's a complicated story.
Kind of hit it head on there, that the fact that he calls out Thunderbird specifically, and then, you know, we all know what happens to Thunderbird, you know, that's kind of
40 years earlier. Yeah, it's kind of an uncomfortable foreshadowing, but it is one of the few Thunderbird stories out there, which is why we're doing it this month. I had a genuine delight hanging out with you both today. I think you're both so wonderful. I love picking your brain about any topic, and you're always welcome back, always, but I'm so pleased to have you, particularly during this month, because we need the right voices sharing this information with people. So I hope we can hang out again anytime, and thank you so much for being here. We're going to put this out in mid-March on the show in just a couple of weeks. So as we're wrapping up, is there anything else you would like to plug, and where can people find you online? Let's go Marcy and then Michael.
I have a website. It's MarcyLaRockwell.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on social media site formerly known as Twitter. I'm mostly on Blue Sky. I have a poetry chapbook that came out this past year called Blood Quantum and Other Hate Crimes, which is obviously filled with Indigenous experience poetry, some horror, some science fiction, some fantasy, some just straight life. I had several award nominated and winning poems in it. So it's by Fallen Tree Press. So I'm pretty proud of that one. And also doing some stuff for some IPs that I can't talk about because they're under NDA right now. But I am working with Connor Alexander and the Coyote and Crow team. They have started doing a cultural consultation to help people who want to include Indigenous elements into their work to do it correctly. So, you know, I just, if you're going to do it, he's assembled a pretty good team. And if we don't have the information that you need, we can point you to somebody who does. So, like, I really encourage anybody who wants to put those elements into their work to do it right. Like, it's not that hard. It's not that hard. And thank you, Chad. And it's great talking to you. It's great talking to you again, Michael. And I hope that we get to do this again soon, because it's a lot of fun.
I can't wait.
So you can catch me at online at Michael Shiashi, all one word, just to make it harder for everyone. MichaelShiashi.com. That's MichaelShiashi.com. As I mentioned, you know, go to the Smithsonian, check out some of the stuff we have there. We also have the Native Knowledge 360 from NMAI's online presence. Check out some of our exhibits there. We have stories of the first Thanksgiving illustrated by many talented individuals, including Dale DeForest, Sada Coronas, Tim Truman. Check out the Newberry Library in Chicago. They have an exhibit of Native American created indigenous games, doing an interface to launch those for them. So check that out later in 2025. Thanks, everyone.
Well, lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I am most easily found at @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. It has been such a joy to put the content for the show together this month. I'm so pleased with what's happening. And thank you so much to Michael and Marcy for coming today. Michael and Marcy will both be with me on the very next episode of the show, out on March 24th, which is the academic panel for the month called About John Proudstar or Thunderbird. We will also be joined by Ben Rome, by John Proudstar, the actor, as well as my friend Scotty White. So everybody stay tuned. And then we'll close up the month with a Giant Size X-Men #4 with my guests David Cutler and Steve Orlando. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you all back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane. Thank you for listening to Gray Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Gray Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell. and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Graham Alkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Graham Alkin Lane.
Looking for your next Subaru? At Byers Airport Subaru, we give you options from start to finish. Browse and shop entirely online from the comfort of your home at columbussubaru.com or stop by and visit one of our friendly brand specialists just by the airport.
During the Subaru A Lot to Love event, buy a new 2025 Subaru Forester for 3.9% for up to 48 months.
Whether you prefer to click or come in, we've got you covered. Your journey starts at Byers Airport Subaru. Come see why it's better to buy at Byers.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 3/31/25.